Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're of the generous sort, you can support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you're able to support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation. And if that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. I'm Zach Crum, and joining me for this episode is Tim Bonvecchio. Tim grew up in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, and received both his Bachelor of Science in Natural Resource Conservation, as well as his Master of Science in Fisheries Management from the University of Florida. Tim specializes in population dynamics and sport fish management, and is currently a senior fisheries biologist with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Resources Division, where he has been for the past 15 years. Previously, he worked for 3 years as a fish biologist for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission on the high-profile Kissimmee Chain of Lakes largemouth bass fishery. Welcome to the podcast, Tim.
Thanks, Zach. Appreciate it. I'm fired up to be here.
All right. So to get us started, how did you first become interested in fish?
So I grew up fishing and working with my two other brothers and my sister on my father's drift fishing boat, the Captain Bob, as well as other local drift boats and sport fishing boats out of Palm Beach, Florida. I saw some really cool things growing up on the blue water, the salt water. Every summer it was like the Discovery Channel. several customers would hook up on fish, and they called these fish little tunnies or bonitas. King mackerel was another schooling fish we caught, and occasionally bluefish. But anyway, these fish, when they get hooked, a lot of times in their school, they'll be bloody, and there'll be a lot of blood everywhere in the water. And so you can imagine what would find us pretty quickly thereafter, wolf pack of sharks, usually bulls, duskies, or sandbars. And it was just a feeding frenzy, people's fish getting eaten off the hook. So that it was mayhem would be the best way for me to describe it. But I would consider that my dream job, but my dad advised me to go back to school because he saw the handwriting on the wall that they couldn't make a living nowadays on that. There was a lot of competition in the business and nowadays and high overhead and things like that. But my personality, I'm an extrovert. I love talking to people. I just worked the deck and knew I just did a really good job on those boats, and I loved it, like a passion. But I just knew that my dad told me, he's like, long term, son, this just isn't going to work out. But I really loved it. But anyway, that's kind of how I got started.
Awesome. That's really cool. Yeah, taking people fishing, and that's a heck of a way to kind of get involved in fisheries. So you get to see a little bit of everything, I'm sure.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Awesome. So from there, you kind of took that interest into your undergrad at the University of Florida, right?
Yep.
So were there any experiences early on in life or in your undergrad at the University of Florida that made you consider pursuing a career in fisheries, or did you kind of know going in that that's what you wanted to do for sure?
So I wasn't really sure exactly what I wanted to do in undergrad. I played a lot of sports in high school, football and baseball. So I thought about being a coach at some point, maybe being a science teacher. So I kind of went that route first in my undergrad. But everything kind of in my life came full circle the last year of my undergrad work. I was still on that, getting a minor in secondary ed and still thinking about doing what I just talked about. But then I took an introduction to fisheries course as part of my natural resource conservation degree. And that basically, that degree was a science degree that had fisheries, wildlife, and forestry in it. So, but I was still thinking I'll be a teacher, but I took this intro to fisheries course in the spring of 2000. I'm dating myself now, unfortunately. This involved electrofishing Lake Alice, which is a fairly large lake on the campus, during the semester and writing up a management plan. I was hooked from that point on. And you've probably heard the story 1,000 times since you've been doing these, but I found what I wanted to be in life. I was like, technician or biologist, I want to do this fishery stuff. This is cool. There was a TA in the class, Beth Sargent, who was a fisheries graduate student, and she mentioned her roommate, Kim, had a project working on Lake Kissimmee, setting block nets with rotenone and evaluating habitat restoration projects. She was looking at fish communities and biomass in these evaluated areas. So I decided to call this Kim and volunteer on the project that summer, June of 2000. This graduate student, Kimberly Tugin, was under the direction of Dr. Michael Allen, a talented young fisheries management professor who was just only a few years in as an assistant professor at Florida. Anyway, I must have won both of them over with my hard work, ethic, and a little charm, because Mike invited me for the rest of the summer as a full-time technician in the lab entering my final semester of undergrad work. And Kim, well, we started dating. And 4 years later, we were married. So now we're 17 plus years married, and we have two wonderful children, two girls, Hannah and Lily. It all kind of came together in that summer. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy. Wow. So you found your first job in fisheries as well as your wife all in one place.
And pretty much in one summer.
That's incredible. That must have been the best summer ever. So once you worked your first job there, did you continue working with Dr. Allen at all?
I did. So he basically brought me on and said, hey, I need a technician into the fall. I got this water level project going on. And I'm like, I need 2 credits in fisheries techniques. Can I do a special project for you, Mike? In addition to taking this, I had one more undergrad class left, astronomy, which ended up being difficult for me, but because I'm not much of a stargazer. But anyway, I did pass. So that's kind of how it got started.
Cool. So then you continued on with your master's there at the University of Florida in fisheries management, right?
Yeah.
So what was your research there focused on?
So essentially, I started that fall of 2000 working on that water level project for Dr. Allen as a technician. But I had no idea until a little bit later in the fall that this would be my master's project that Mike had planned for me to take on. He just said, you taking the GRE, blah, blah. And then next thing you know, he's like, you know, you've started on your master's degree and you need to apply because in January you're taking classes. I'm like, whoa. I was like, cool. I was really enjoying it and I didn't, you know, that it was perfect. But my research was entitled Relations Between Hydrological Variables and Year Class Strength of Sport Fish in 8 Florida Water Bodies. Essentially, does water level affect sport fish year class strength in rivers or lakes in Florida? We wrote that up and published it in 2005 in Hydrobiologia for anybody who wants to look it up. But essentially, water levels affect recruitment, whether it's in a lake or a river. And so I looked at annual and seasonal water variables related to year class strength. So we use residuals and a catch curve. Iron Mike Messina was the first one that coined that term. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, but awesome professor that was that influenced Dr. Allen as well. And so basically looked at 6 different sport fish, the most common ones in each of these systems, 3 or 4 of them in each of the 8 water bodies. So I didn't do all 6 species in each water body, but it was 3 or 4 that were, well, we could collect 8 samples on basically in a relatively short amount of time, a few weeks in a season. Then we used multiple. So we looked at year class strength, what was more strongly related to, it ended up being more strongly related in system hydrology in rivers than in lakes. So we found more results in the 4 rivers than we did in the 4 lakes. But basically we used multiple regression equations and found that black bass year class strength was, well, I guess I didn't mention the 6 species we looked at, but 2 black bass, largemouth and swanee bass. And obviously swanees are only found in rivers, but largemouth in all 8 water bodies we looked at. Bluegill, red ear sunfish, red breast sunfish, and black crappie. So we looked at multiple regression equations and we found that black bass year class strength was often negatively related to spring flow rates in rivers. And conversely, Lipoma species, that's bluegill, redbreast, residuals combined for the rivers indicated that year class strength was positively related to flow rates in the fall. So one of the implications of this work included regulations such as minimum flows and levels regarding sport fish species. At the time and probably now, there's a high water demand in Florida. So if you're pulling water out, how's that going to affect the fish populations? High flows at least once every 3 years in the fall may allow inundation of floodplain habitat, providing favorable environmental conditions for Lipoma species. So we set MFL or minimum flows and levels during periods of drought for three or more years. Need to consider the impacts of these short-lived Lipoma species.
Awesome. Okay, so that was that where you kind of developed a love for research and population dynamics through that project? Yeah.
I don't have the exact number in front of me, but we killed over 6,000 fish in that project and measured 19,000 fish. And so we used age length keys and extrapolated that 6,000 to the 19,000. So it aged some serious amount of fish with a saw.
Yeah, that's incredible. That must have been quite a bit of time on the water and in the lab there.
It was field and lab intensive, which is, if you've ever talked to an Allen student in our lab, that was par for the course.
All right, so what was it like working with largemouth in the Kissimmee chain of lakes? I've heard a lot about that, not from Florida, but you know, you hear about trophy bass fishing in different parts of the world. What was it like working with largemouth in that area?
Yeah, so I kind of got hooked during grad school. My professor was also working on a water level habitat evaluation on Lake Kissimmee, so we did age and growth on that lake down there, and it kind of got me hooked on that chain. And I was like, man, if I could get a job in that area, it'd be cool. And my wife, she got a job in Eustace in Orlando, which was a little bit north of Orlando, in Eustace, which was within an hour of Kissimmee. So it seemed like if we're both going to be fish biologists, by the way, then maybe we should, we can kind of get close together there on our jobs. But it was a lot of fun. I did a bunch of electrovision and run krill surveys on some awesome bass and crappie lakes. I saw a lot of big bass. I did work several high profile BASS tournaments and bass tournaments in general. It opened my eyes to water temperature being a critical component of tournament mortality on black bass species. Typically, if the tournament is held in the winter or the early spring, it isn't much of a problem. But as those spring water temperatures start increasing and you're holding 70 degrees or higher, you start a longer period of time in a live well, that mortality starts going up in summertime, May, June tournaments. I'm holding in whales for 6-8 hours. I don't recommend.
Right.
Nowadays, I think bump board and kayak tournaments, or observers on the boat, I think they've come a long way with that. I'm not a huge fan of the glory photos holding them up, because the fish have been held in the water in the wells for 6-8 hours. But as you know, I realized it's not that these bass populations can't take a little mortality. We know catch and release has gone through the roof in these populations, but it's the biggest fish at the top of the pyramid that are being targeted in these tournaments, the 5 to 10 pound fish in the lake. And that's what anglers are targeting. So,
right.
You know, if they're done in the wrong period of time, you could influence a lake if it's small enough just by taking the big fish out of the lake and a higher amount of mortality. So that's a concern in my opinion.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I was on the Virginia Tech bass fishing team in my undergrad, and that's definitely something I noticed. Some of our tournaments that were closer to the summer season is definitely some more mortality, and it's, I know there's a lot of research coming out on it kind of in the last decade or so. So it's really interesting to see kind of the ways that the tournament fishing industry will adapt to some of this mortality.
Yeah, I mean, under a normal growth situation, bass grow about 1 pound a year, and it takes a while for a bass to reach trophy status. So if people are hammering and targeting the biggest fish to have the biggest bag all the time, it really could influence the top of the pyramid of the fish population. I did so many catch curves growing up in my schoolwork. You can tell as they get older, you catch less and less older fish in the population when you're aging them.
Right.
So if you're seeing a bunch of 7 to 10 pounders in a pretty small lake that's being turned in, it's like, that's a good portion of the population probably.
Yeah. So you've worked quite a bit with bass in your career up to this point.
Yeah, I have.
So I've been reading, you know, a little bit about some of the programs you've worked on, and I was really interested in hearing about the female-only stocking strategy that you use with Georgia DNR in one of your public fishing areas there. Can you tell us just a little bit about that program and how it's set up?
Yeah, sure. So I can't take credit for that stocking strategy. A previous DNR biologist and regional supervisor, Les Ager, came up with that strategy. He had seen it being done in private management on some smaller lakes with some success. So I can't take credit for that. I kind of picked up on it and have run with it a little bit. You know, most public fishing areas and small impoundments are managed for balance. And so this is completely outside the box way of thinking here. And it's really turned into a really cool fishery. And we've got a few around the state, but Ogmulgee is the biggest one at 106 acres. But so normal stocking rates for bass is 50 to 100 bass per acre. Both genders, and depending on if it's fertilized or unfertilized, the system, liming and fertilizer. So that will, and a normal lake with both genders. But I think to see tremendous growth with not much. And so, like I said, I'm not really, this is kind of what the guys did in the past with these female strategies. I've kind of adapted to that. I think to see tremendous growth with not much competition for resources, somewhere in the 15 to 20 fish per acre of female only is where you need to be. Our warm water fisheries hatcheries around our state have perfected the recipe of growing out these bass, catchable bass in a forage soup on the hatchery of threadfin and bluegill in the ponds. In their first year, they grow them out to 10 to 12 inches long. So you're basically, you harvest a pond and they're 10 to 12 inches long, but when you stock the pond at 1 to 2 inches, 1 to 2 inch fish, approximately 120 per acre. And then we put them in this forage soup for a year and let them grow out. And then survival is somewhere between 50 and 100% in a pond in a given year. But then you go to sex them a year later, we used a little glass pipette and we inserted up the urogenital pore. And if you get eggs, they're basically viable at 10 to 12 months old, basically. And you get eggs, pit tag them, and we throw them on the trailer, and they head to Ogmulgee, just females. And it's fairly accurate. If you don't get eggs, we don't put it on the trailer. So our goal in the past 5+ years was to get to 20 per acre, with maximizing better catch rates for anglers, but also produce some monster bass. That's the idea. I mean, we have the world record and we're trying to defend it. I'll leave it at that. But we're now there after 5-6 years in the lake. Anyway, the oldest year class is 6.5 right now in Ogmulgee PFA. Unfortunately, males have gotten in the system from an upper drainage pond. There's a 6 or 7 acre lake up in the upper drainage. So the genie's out of the bottle, so to speak, for this lake this go around. I'm now seeing recruitment of both genders that they don't have pit tags. But it's a small amount. It's not huge. And yeah, we're continuing to remove them. But I'd say we're at 25 per acre based on recapture rates right now. Males are being actively removed, but the population is growing now. So more competition, unfortunately. At some point, we're going to have to put harvest on it, probably. Right now, it's catch and release.
Okay. Yeah. Do a lot of people come from the state to fish that area? Like, is it a pretty popular fishing destination?
Yeah. So we have a creel survey plan to look at that. But I do see a lot of plates from Atlanta and further north. I think people drive 2 hours to try to catch the fish of a lifetime. And then there's a lot of 6 to 10 pound fish in the lake.
So it's
pretty neat. I've caught a couple of them, but.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I saw that you shocked at what was it? A 12 pound
large 13 and
13.
I'll go into that a little later in one of the questions that you had told me that you guys do at the end, but essentially we have shocked. The lake record is 10 pounds, 10 ounces, but I think we've had our hands on 3 or 4 fish over that. So we know they're out there and people haven't caught them. So it's really kind of funny. There's a good amount of fishing effort out there. But the fish have become educated a little bit, I think.
All right. So I guess we'll transition over from bass into some other species there in Georgia. I've been reading a little bit about blue and flathead catfish on the East Coast lately, and I was curious in what areas you've seen them expand down there in Georgia.
Yeah, so they're native only. Blues and flatheads are both native only to the Coosa system in northwest Georgia. But we've found blues and flatheads. They're now found in most systems across Georgia. There's a few systems they're not found in. The blues and flats are not found in the St. Mary's River, which is a Florida-Georgia line river. Flats are not found in the Suwannee and its associated drainages that I know of. They found one individual in the Ogeechee River. They haven't found any more since. So there's a few rivers scattered here and there that don't have flats or blues in them. But for the most part, unfortunately, they have been introduced. A colleague of mine that now works for the Fish and Wildlife Service, Adam Kaiser, and I helped him with this, but he wrote up a flathead introduction history in Georgia, and it's in the Catfish 2010 book. But essentially, flats were introduced in the Flint in the 50s, the Okmulgee in the late 60s, early 70s, Altamaha River in the 80s, Sotilla in the 90s. Blues were originally detected in Lake Sinclair in 96 and 97 through Georgia DNR gillnet sampling, and they spread down through the Altamaha system in the mid-2000s. We found, my Sotilla River flathead removal crew found blues in 2010 in the Sotilla River for the first time, and now they are established.
Are you and other Georgia DNR biologists kind of working on surveys assessing their populations, or is there anything going on at the moment?
Yeah, so in the south part of the state, I know a couple different regions. We do routine summer low-frequency electrofishing for catfish, standardized sampling, annually or biennially, it depends on the river and the region. Because they're blues and flats, they're all introduced in the south here. There's no size limits on these introduced blues or flats, and no limit on them. There's a lot of monitoring that goes on at this point.
Have you seen any responses in some of the other sport fish populations to the expansion of catfish?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Myself and colleagues have seen inverse relationships, especially pretty early on in native fish populations as these invasive catfish become established. As far as the blues in Lake Sokoni and Sinclair, the gillnet surveys showed rapid declines in white catfish, corresponding with rapidly increasing blue cat populations. You can see Michael Homer and Cecil Jennings from UGA, their publication on that work, they saw some really stark inverse relationships. Many studies show declines in native fish populations where piscivorous flatheads have been introduced in Georgia. Our previous chief, Matt Thomas, he reported back in 93 declines in the Altamaha River redbreasts and native bullhead populations. Also, I documented with a couple of the biologists I work with, Don Harrison and Bert Diener, Waycross office here, we documented declines in with a standardized sampling data set from the Sotilla River, declines in bass, bluegill, and redbreast as a result of flathead invasion in the Sotilla, which started in the mid-90s, but that data set's in 2009. But yeah, stark declines.
Okay, so I have read a little bit about your Sotilla River flathead catfish removal project, and you've touched on a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit more about how this project is set up?
Yeah, so I did it for 9 years. That's how I was brought in Georgia DNR in 06. I did it through 14 or 15, somewhere in that range, 14, I think. We wrote up some pretty neat results in the 2010 Catfish Symposium 77. Basically, yes, we documented substantial shifts in the age structure, condition, size structure, and biomass of the Sotilla population over a pretty short amount of time with our intensive removal, 2 to 3 years period. Those graphs, the length frequency histograms, are phenomenal, how much they shifted. We started out with a lot of age 4-plus-year-old fish, and within a couple of years, we had 0 to 2-year-olds, and you know, all those sizes declined. It appeared that shortly thereafter, though, we saw high recruitment based on the length frequency histograms of the flatheads, as well as an increase in catch per unit effort, so CPUE did increase.
Huh.
We also observed that some fish matured at smaller sizes.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. I was going to ask, was there a response in the population to quicker maturation with smaller fish?
Yeah, this hadn't been reported in the literature. We surmised that reduction in age of maturity is a compensatory response due to reduced stock size of the fish. Yeah, higher exploitation on later maturing individuals may also have contributed to those changes.
All right. Cool. So it sounds like you've spent quite a bit of time out on an electrofishing boat in your career. Was there, or do you have any stories or anything that's come up in your years of experience out on the water that have been particularly exciting or unexpected?
So I thought I was ate up with fishing until I met this guy. I met some really awesome people in my career, and my professor, Mike Allen, has just been quite an impact on me. But no person more passionate about trophy bass fishing than Edward Porter Hall. I was fortunate to be introduced to Porter through Mike Allen. Porter is a journeyman, lifetime trophy bass fisherman that has caught, I'm not stuttering here, 655 bass over 10 pounds. And he's caught 42 bass over 13 pounds. Yeah, 42 teen-sized bass, including an 18.35-pounder from Lake Casitas in California. Porter is the trophy king. Anyway, Porter has worked in fisheries as well. And Porter teamed up with my old professor, Mike, to do a he's not old, but anyway, my professor, to do a population estimate of trophy Florida bass over 8 pounds in a lake, Collin Panther Lake in Crystal Springs, Mississippi. It was a new lake, but it was busting at the seams with big bass back in 2010 and 2011. Anyway, at this time, I got to help Porter sample these fish. You know, a lot of people think you don't shock as many big fish in proportion to what's in the population with an electrofishing boat. Well, we all know electrofishing isn't that effective, but if you have the trophy bass king as your guide and you're targeting them with hook and line, you can catch some big fish. And so anyway, they devised a pit tag all bass over 8 pounds in this lake and do a population estimate. Anyway, one day I was out sampling with Porter. We were fishing. July 30th, 2010. And Porter and I caught 8 bass over 10 pounds. 8 Florida bass in Mississippi over 10 pounds in one day. I only had 2 of them. I netted 4 11-pounders in a row with Porter before I said, "Can you let me catch one?" Anyway, I ended up catching my biggest bass of my life, a 12.5-pounder. The biggest one of the day as well. So we had over 90 pounds with 8 bass. And the best 5 was 58 pounds. So eat your heart out, Kevin Van Dam. Anyway, that study revealed a population estimate of 150 bass in the lake over 8 pounds, with a confidence interval of 118 to 206, density 0.92 fish per acre, 95% confidence interval, between 0.73 and 1.26. But we wrote this paper up in North American Journal of Fisheries Management, and we just got it published 2 years ago. See, Porter Hall et al. And a few other co-authors helped us, including Mike Allen, in 2019. So that was an awesome study, and there are several successful sampling trips, but that one was epic.
Yeah, that's incredible. I guess that is one of the perks of being a fisheries biologist, is being able to fish for work. So whenever you can do that, you're doing pretty good. And that sounds like
off the clock at that time, but it doesn't matter.
That's awesome.
Still wrote it up.
Awesome. So I guess I'll kind of transfer into our next question here. So how have you been able to kind of get involved with the American Fisheries Society throughout your career as a fisheries biologist?
So Mike Allen at UF pushed AFS as a really good building block for us graduate students to get involved and to make connections. And as you're learning, this fisheries is not, we're not, it's not that big a field, and everybody gets to know everybody after a while. So yeah, I'm a certified fisheries professional with AFS. I've been very active in the Southern Division. You know, I was a Florida chapter member, now a Georgia chapter member. But I was the president of the Georgia chapter from 13 and 14. I've been a member, I think, since I started at Georgia. I got the Fisheries Worker of the Year Award with that Georgia chapter in 2010. That was a cool award to get.
That's awesome. Yeah.
I'm a member of the Board of Appeals on the Parent Society, and for that fisheries professional stuff. I was also a chair for the Catfish Technical Committee, and from 14 to 16. I've been active in the Small Impoundments Committee, since that's what I work on a lot now. Member of AFS for quite a while now. Can't remember the exact date. I've also done some associate editor with North American Journal of Fisheries Management. So I've been really active.
Yeah, you've done quite a bit. That's really cool. Hearing how some of the different fisheries professionals get involved in different capacities is always interesting. One thing I'm really excited to start talking about with different fisheries professionals as I go through my interviews each month is sort of the advice that they would give to undergraduate students or maybe those that are early career professionals. Do you have any particular advice that you would give?
Yeah, so it kind of came out a little bit in the earlier part of the interview. There's no substitute for hard work. Volunteer first to get your foot in the door. That's what I did. You got to crawl before you walk. Skills are cheap and can be learned, but passion for what you do is priceless. And that's kind of a little bit of my take home. I just think that you got to work hard if you want to get anywhere, and people will notice.
Okay, that's great. I think that's some great advice. I'm sure, it'll be really useful for those that are just kind of starting off. All right, so I guess that kind of concludes all the difficult questions, but I guess we'll kind of transfer into our final five questions that we ask each of the guests that come on the show. And I don't know, I've actually heard that these questions have been some of the hardest, so maybe you'll have a different take on it. But for our first question, what is your favorite fish?
So I kind of stewed back and forth with a few, but I ended up the Swanee bass, Micropterus noteus. My major professor, Mike Allen, introduced me to this magnificent football-shaped fish. Doesn't get super long. It's a super cool bass that only exists in Florida and Georgia. It actually describes my life to a T. So many ties in both states, except for football now. I bleed orange and blue. Florida grown, but now working in Georgia for most of my adult life. But my wife works for Florida FWC. So anyway, me and my co-authors ended up doing age and growth on this fish, and also found in my thesis the year class strength through residual analysis was negative related to lower flow rates in Florida rivers, which is actually similar to what a Virginia Department of Game and Fish biologist, Scott Smith, found with smallmouth bass on the New River, and low flows being tied to strong year classes. So that's kind of a cool tie. But later on in my career, we also developed the relative weight equation for this cool Swanee bass. And just recently, I've worked with Dr. Marty Hamill at the University of Georgia on exploitation and movement of these special black bass. We did this study in Georgia because we're promoting our black bass slam. We can catch 10 different species in Georgia. Anyway, I'll let Marty's grad student, Joel Yeager, reveal those results on those studies. They're done, and he should be presenting those at big meetings soon. But just a cool fish. We used to go out for 4 hours on the Santa Fe River before the Florida game and catch 20, 30 Swanee bass in a morning in a 4 or 5 hour float, and then go home and watch the game. But it was just pretty cool fish to. So that's my favorite fish, black bass, and one of the prettiest, I argue.
That's really cool. The second question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
So that one was difficult. I got it down to three. I guess we'll start in March of 2005. I was shocking with FWC fish biologist Adrian Landrum on Lake Hatchnahall in the Kissimmee chain. We rolled a 12-pound, 14-ounce bass and a 13 even in the same time along the edge of the giant bulrush. And I dipped them both up in the same net, and then I had to figure out how to get it in the boat. But basically, had, 25 plus almost 26 pounds, put them into the box. And Adrian just shut the boat off. The transect, she paused it and said, "We got to look at this fish." It was pretty amazing. So that was my first, that was a cool memory.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So now we fast forward a little bit to June of 2010. I was conducting with my crews the removal of flatheads on the Scintilla, and a former technician, Justin Bythewood, was with me, and he scooped up this, 15-inch flathead. It was the first one of the day. Flipped it into the cooler, we're removing them. I just kind of, as Justin flipped it in the cooler, I saw something gray move around in the cooler. I was like, "What is that?" And I flipped the cooler lid back open, and it had regurgitated about a 5-inch Atlantic sturgeon. that it had eaten it, and it was the first fish of the day, the flathead. So I was like, I just looked at Justin. I'm like, you just got on the publication. So
yeah,
we wrote that up, and it was just a cool finding to find that Atlantic sturgeon in the belly of that flathead. And my buddy Cecil Jennings from UGA, he says, that's what we call a gee whiz publication. So I think that's a cool, just a cool memory of part of my career anyway. Last but certainly not least, shocking that 13-pound bass in the Okmulgee PFA with fisheries technician Aaron Gray. Aaron's now working on his master's in Texas Tech. But in February of 2020 on the Okmulgee public fishing area, I knew we were out sampling, spring sample. I knew there was big fish in the lake up to that point. We had shocked an 11.5-pounder that was 4 years old. With the pit tag verified how old it was. So I knew that the oldest fish in the lake were 5.5. So I was shocked when I got back to the office after Aaron had dipped that 13-pounder and we scanned the tag and I looked it up on the computer that it was only a 4-year-old fish, 4.5, not a little over 4 and not 5. But this is what's cool. I had some previous data on the fish. So we stocked it in February 2017 as a 3/4-pound, 1-year-old fish from Richmond Hill Hatchery. We didn't restock that fish until a 3-year-old in 2019, and it was 7.82 pounds at the time as a 3-year-old. And this year, as a 4-year-old, it was 13 pounds. So that fish grew 5.18 pounds between the ages of 3 and 4. She had a relative weight of 165.
Oh my God.
So those are kind of cool things. I'm just kind of like, wow, man, I'm, you know, so guys and gals have done an awesome job with growing these fish out and then throwing them in that lake. And that fish, I don't think I'll ever shock a prettier, more robust 13 by 24 inch. I mean, it was almost just as girthy, 23.5 inch girth. So
that's incredible. Wow. Sounds like you got some awesome memories.
That was neat. But that, so I can only get it down to 3. So you're right. That is a tough question.
All right. So what would your dream job be and your dream location?
Well, first of all, I want this to be clear that I'm happy, very happy in my composition. I get to do enough research on the management that we do that it quenches my thirst for being a biologist. But in a perfect world, had I stayed in school and attempted to get a PhD, a research coordinator position with USGS or a university might have been fun also. But I'm not sure I would have liked the publisher-perisher mentality of a big university setting. So don't get me wrong, I like to publish, but that might be too much pressure for me. But, you know, nowadays, those positions a lot, and most of them need a PhD, so anyway, yeah. I'm happy where I'm at, but if I had to, that would be a route I could have chosen. So,
gotcha. Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you got a pretty amazing job, so I don't blame you there. All right, so if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
So this one stumped me a little while, but if money was not an option, as a passionate trophy bass biologist and trophy bass fisherman, if I was given a new lake or a lake to renovate every 3 to 5 years, I could continue to tinker with these different big bass recipes and attempt to grow a world record bass and selfishly catch that big girl. But it's no secret that the lake record is typically produced in the first 5 to 15 years of a new impoundment. Then it's time to hit the reset switch and start over. So we've kind of known that. But anyway, that's in a perfect world. So,
yeah, absolutely. Just grow mega bass. I think that's awesome. So if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
So I came across Vince Lombardi had a quote that I like. The price of success is hard work, dedication to the job at hand, and the determination that whether we win or lose, we've applied the best of ourselves to the task at hand. So it's kind of a consistent theme of mine. Hard work will pay off.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Hard work and dedication is key to anything, really.
Yeah, no doubt. I can't stress enough to undergrads that volunteering, you know, and just getting your foot in the door. If you're cut from a good mold, you'll impress. You have to work. You have to be a hard worker. to get anywhere in life if you want to see results.
Great. So that kind of concludes our interview here. So if listeners would like to get in contact with you, what's going to be the best way to do that?
Yeah, so there's two ways. Obviously, you can email me at tim.bonvecchio@dnr.ga.gov, or you can find me on ResearchGate also, and some of the stuff we've mentioned today in this interview, but I don't know if I need to read that byline or not. But if you just look up Timothy Bonvecchio, there's only one. So you can find me on ResearchGate that way. I just appreciate y'all having me. It's kind of a walk back into my career a little bit. Kind of scary that I'm approaching mid-career, but I don't know, man. It's when you're passionate about your job, it's not a job, you know? So
yeah, no, exactly. So, well, yeah, I really appreciate you being on the show today. It was really great hearing about some of the amazing things that you've worked on, and there truly has been a lot. So I think it's been awesome to have you on.
No, I appreciate you having me, Zach.
Yeah, absolutely. If you would like to get a hold of us at the Fisheries Podcast, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or by email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon, or by rocking some Fisheries Podcast logo merch available on Teespring. I'm Zach Crum, and thank you for listening to the 140th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember that hard work and dedication will pay off.